Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 60 of Josh Nason's Punch-Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. I'm Josh Nason, writer, editor, and podcaster for the site, former writer for Bloody Elbow, Fight Magazine, Bleacher Report, and a bunch of other websites that no longer exist, coming to you somewhat live from an undisclosed location somewhere in Seacoast, New Hampshire, one that's obviously not too hard to find. Hope you guys are doing great, having a great week. My voice is a little raspy, fighting off a cold, so I'm going to keep this a little bit brief, which you're probably cheering about right now. I'm going to continue with our series, looking back at the year 2016. Obviously, no real MMA going on except for this weekend coming up. So we want to put 2016 in the rearview mirror, and that's why we brought in very special guest Dave Doyle of MMAfighting.com. Dave and I talked for a little over an hour about the most interesting, newsworthy, transformative quarter of the year, if you're into that type of stuff, so Q3. So many things that happened, obviously UFC 200, everything surrounding that with the UFC sale, obviously with UFC 202, McGregor-Diaz 2, and all kinds of other news. This was I keep saying the word fun. This is such a fun time to take in as a fan, to write about, to talk about, and everything in between. So Dave was great to stop by and chat about that. I will note this interview was actually recorded before UFC 207, so before Rousey versus Nunes. So he refers back to, the Rousey stuff or anything like that. Just kind of keep that in mind. This is actually recorded before that year-end show. So without further ado, let's get to Dave Doyle of MMAfighting.com talking about 2016's Q3. Well, in our continued look back at the year that was 2016, we bring back some of our favorite guests from the year that was, and that's why I'm happy to be joined by the Chris Sale of MMAfighting.com, and he also does some work for some other sites as well. The one and only Dave Doyle. And Dave, we welcome you back with open arms and bro hugs and such. And I have a very easy question to start out with, and that would be, how was your year?
My year. Wow. I know we're supposed to say that 2016 was the worst year anyone's had ever, but I had a pretty good year. I'm not going to lie. I had a pretty satisfying year professionally. I rode a bike from Los Angeles to San Diego, which that's not your everyday thing. I went over to Ireland. I watched the Conor McGregor fight at UFC 202 at a pub in Dublin at 6 in the morning with a bunch of my fellow Irishmen who I didn't know until I actually went over there and saw them drinking at 4:30 in the morning as if it was still 9 o'clock. Since I'm Irish, I can say that some stereotypes are true. And personally speaking, I had a pretty solid year. How about awesome. You?
I would say the same. We're just talking off air, and I mentioned became a dad for the first time in October, and it's been awesome, challenging, but awesome. And I think very similar to you, to your mentality there, that so many people are like, 2016, it's the worst, it's in blah, blah, and because I think a lot because the Trump stuff, and then all these celebrities are dying.
Sure, of course.
But I think everyone, they kind of look in their personal circles and stuff, and I know, you've been doing a lot of the charity stuff, and just everyone... Everyone can find really positive things that happened, and I think that's kind of the mentality I like to take is that, look, there's the stuff that you can't control outside your circle, but in the stuff that you have, if your friends are good, your family are good, you're good, and you're on the right path, I mean, that's really all you can ask for,
The spoiler alert for 2017 is that celebrities that you never met are going to keep dying. Go out there and live your own life and enjoy it. That's my advice, now that you asked.
We always like your advice. You're a good New England guy, and that's what we like on the show. So let's talk about some other men and women in this profession that is mixed martial arts. And we're going to go over July, August, and September. And I know when we were kind of jockeying around the schedule and stuff, and you said, is it possible to do Q3 instead of Q2? I think you made a great choice because in going over this three-month stretch, this is, to me, the most eventful three-month stretch in the company's history. And really, July is probably the most eventful month. And we're going to get into it. And again, for people that don't know, for some reason it's your first one you're listening to, I go through all the headlines for the month, and I kind of pick out what I think are kind of the top two or three. And then we just kind of go over some of the other headlines and all that good stuff. I think for July, really, the big one, the biggest headline, glaring, and it really is kind of one and 1A, is this everything that happened around UFC 200. And we'll get to the sales stuff in a minute. But UFC 200, let me just kind of run down this bullet list. So obviously it's 200, so it's this numbered event, right? The way the numbered events, the summertime, all this stuff is just kind of a big thing before we even know one fight in the card. John Jones gets pulled from his fight, his main event fight with Daniel Cormier, the big rematch, just I think three days prior, I believe, due to a drug test failure, turned out to be metabolites and estrogen inhibitor. Anderson Silva was then pulled in off the street literally to face Daniel Cormier in just one of these crazy things. All these names are being thrown around with Musasi, Bisping, Henderson, and probably some other ones that were leaving out. Brock Lesnar returned on this show after a long absence out of nowhere. And, Amanda Nunes and Miesha Tate, that fight all of a sudden get put up to the main event. Amanda Nunes beats Miesha Tate, takes that title, puts herself in line for a big fight coming on down the way. Johnny Hendricks is on this card, misses weight again. Cain Velasquez returns. Oh, by the way, Jose Aldo wins 145-pound interim featherweight title against Frankie Edgar, despite the fact that the current featherweight champion is fighting on the show. There are so many just names. Julian Pena versus Katsangano was on the show. And then there's all the stuff that happened after this. This was if you look back on it, a lot of people say, you know, some of the action was kind of stale as compared to, you know, what we'd see at Madison Square Garden later in the year. But just from a news and headline perspective, UFC 200 was incredible.
It was unreal. And, you know, I was thinking as you were kind of listing off everything that kind of came out of that, you also have to consider, if you wind the clock back a little bit, UFC 200 was announced like a year before the show actually happened, right? They actually back in July of the previous year said, hey, we're going to have our first show, UFC 200, first show at the new arena in Las Vegas. So that, because they made such a big deal of this so far in advance, they set the bar absolutely ridiculously high for themselves that they had to put on. Not only was it the first show in Las Vegas at the new arena, the first show at the new arena in Las Vegas, but also it was, everyone was going to make the comparison to UFC 100, which was on the very same weekend 7 years earlier in the same city. So it seemed like there was like an entire year's buildup of like, well, what can they do to make this just the most gigantic, biggest promotion they've ever done? And before we even got to the point where we had the John Jones DC main event, if you go back a few months before any fights were announced, the first thing everyone assumed would be, oh, hey, they'll just do the Ronda Rousey Holly Holm rematch for this, or it'll shatter all records and blah blah blah, and then it just turned into this out of control like little hype train. So by those accounts, by how much expectations went into this show, they really made things difficult for themselves in terms of putting together a show that lived up to the own expectations that they set for themselves. So all the things that we had to go through just to get the fight night, which included originally scheduling that Conor McGregor versus Nate Diaz rematch, it was just a crazy roller coaster ride. If you look at it, the entire context that, you never knew what twist and turn was going to come next.
Yeah. And that's what we talked about in our Q2 review, was all the Conor stuff leading up to it. That bizarre set of circumstances that had Conor on the show, you know, him retiring, and then, he was kicked off the show, didn't want to come to press conference. Then later he said he was on the show again, and just the way that mainstream media was kind of picking this up, and you didn't know who to believe, and then all of a sudden they get this great other main event in Jones-Cormier, and just a few days before, I'll never forget all of a sudden, Dana's got a big announcement. This, I believe, was 9 o'clock night East Coast time. And we had no idea what it was. We were kind of speculating. Obviously, something's happening on the show. I'm like, God, someone must have got hurt. Maybe it's Brock or something bad happened. And then all of a sudden they threw out this this John Jones thing. And this was, you know, in a very, very bad year for John Jones, this was the crowning achievement of terrible, if there is such a thing. And just the biggest show, this big spotlight, and then this this latest failure. And then, of course, you know, in this whole UFC 200 quagmire, just very shortly after that, we find out Brock Lesnar also fails a USADA test. We find out later, both out of competition and in competition, and then just the circumstances around this whole thing. In the lead up, he's going to get the 4-month exemption was going to be waived. He said he was being tested all over the place and in so many tests, passing all this stuff, and then all of a sudden he fails these tests, and just this. This crazy circumstance about why, you know, he was tested before, why aren't the results in yet? This seems to be kind of an ongoing thing, USADA. This was just an added layer of, like, WTF to this whole UFC 200 thing, and just fitting it in just how this event, the aftermath of this event.
Yeah, it really did. You know, as you just kind of laid out, it just seemed like, as on and on as we went, it was never quite everything that could go wrong did, but it was pretty close to it. You know, like you said, that whole evening when they made the press conference with Jones, and I mean, everyone was, they're just heartbroken for Daniel Cormier, knowing everything that he had gone through to get to that point. It looked like he wasn't going to have a fight. And then Anderson Silva coming out of the woodwork, and there was just an absolute, a huge flash of excitement that, oh, hey, Anderson's going to come in and save the day. And if you remember when he came out in the arena that night, there was a giant pop from the crowd when he came in. And then as soon as the fight started, it was like, oh, yeah, this is 41-year-old Anderson Silva fighting on 2 days' notice. And it just kind of deflated the crowd. And it was pretty weird in hindsight how they took it all out on Cormier, who had done nothing wrong. But again, it was a strange night. Like I said, from the very get go, there was just a weird vibe. It was a little, you know, when you watch Brock Lesnar against Mark Hunt, I mean, you don't have to be a pharmacist to suspect that there's something a little weird in Lesnar getting a second wind in the third round after he hadn't been participating in God knows how many years, 5 years or so. So, I mean, yeah, I know I'm kind of struggling to put my finger on it, but it was just a really weird event. Everything seemed strange about it. Nothing really came out of the show itself that, other than the Aldo fight, really, that necessarily moved the ball forward for the UFC and brought them to their big event. It still ended up doing big business. It could have done better, a little bit better business. Of course, I'm saying that about one of the biggest fights in history, but you know, it was just, after all that buildup, it was just strange fight week.
And two other things on top of that. One, I completely forgot about. One was the fact that Nunes Tate was put in the main event slot. And just the way that ended, you know, there was such a positive buzz for Miesha Tate. Just very, you know, big fan favorite, all this stuff in many news, not necessarily really kind of know a fully known entity, obviously. And then she just blitzes Miesha Tate and then just has a celebration afterward. And it just, it felt like a flat finish to the show, even though we had this, there was no controversy in it. She just went out there and just buzzsawed Tate. But it's just, it was just a weird way to end the show. And also the thing I forgot was the gold mat. And this gold mat was just, it was ugly. It was so Trump-esque.
That was terrible, right?
It was awful. It was Trump-esque. You know, everything's gold, right? It just was, you saw it visually, and it was like this mustard-colored thing, and it was just, it really set a very strange non-UFC tone for the night. And I don't know. I think you kind of, like you said earlier, struggling to put the finger on what a strange fight week it was. That was like the mustard colored icing on the cake, you know, that gold.
It really was. That was that on top of everything else, it gave the event kind of almost a minor league looking feel, which was the opposite of what they were going for. And it was also, I got to tell you, I was there that night. It was a terrible crowd in Las Vegas. It was a crowd that was it had been a very long time when I first started covering UFC events around like 2005 or so, I'd go out to Vegas and there would be uneducated fans who would, like, you know, boo when it hit the mat, or, you know, they weren't educated to anyone who except for the stars. And it had been years and years and years since I felt that same vibe, that there were just people that were there to see a big event who weren't necessarily fans. So that didn't help either. And, you know, in the case of Nunez, that's really, I'm still not going to second guess the decision to put the Tate fight in the main event slot, because I respect that at least as of a few months ago, the UFC was still trying to do the traditional thing in keeping the title fight as the headliner.
Yeah.
But, you know, it didn't come off as bad. I mean, it didn't come off as good in practice as it did in theory. And it's too bad. You know, Misha is one of the most popular fighters in the company. She's based out of Las Vegas now. The fans know her. They didn't really know Nunez, which is still a problem on the UFC's front. You know, Amanda Nunez is a wonderfully talented fighter, and she's got a good backstory. First LGBT champion openly. And she's also, she has a great personality. So the UFC has been just dropping the ball over and over and over on a fighter that they could make a star out of. So it did fall flat. It certainly wasn't Amanda Nunez's fault that it happened that way, but you're right. Unfortunately, it even though it shouldn't have, it ended up making the show end in a whimper.
We then go to the 1A biggest story of the month, and this was something obviously that was rumored and finally was confirmed just a few days after UFC 200, was that the UFC was sold for $4+ billion, WMEIMG, a name that they said they'll be changing hopefully at some point in the future. We talked a lot about this in the last show as far as kind of just the build and the discussion and all this stuff, and finally it happened. The Vertitta brothers cashing out, Dana White cashing out very big and still staying around with the company, something about the tune of around $360 million Dana was getting from this, still sticking around in his president role, and also his gang believes either 6% or 9% of company profits going forward. This was just the UFC was sold. And I think just the mainstream chatter that it got with just this, you know, how the thing was kind of positioned as far as, like, you know, it's bigger than this sports property and bigger than this and bigger than this. And some people try and compare it to NFL and NBA teams, and just it's kind of a little bit different. But still, $4 billion is still $4 billion. We still haven't got a press conference yet from any of the owners, which I thought was, I talked about before, I think is just the most bizarre thing. I can't get over the fact that this $4 billion purchase was made and no one wanted to do a big press event saying, this is why we bought it. You know, this is just, it's amazing. I can't get over that. But anyway, I mean, do you remember kind of like what your mentality was, what you were thinking at the time when this whole thing was happening? And then finally when it was like, it's going ahead and this thing is being sold. What were you thinking at the time?
That my first thought was, cause it, that news broke. I mean, it had been long rumored, but the actual breaking of the news came late on Sunday night, right after, everything had ended for UFC 200. And I think I was in my hotel room and I was just like, are you effing kidding me? Just in terms of the timing of having a major news story like that drop at that particular time. But, you know, I mean, you just, even though I wouldn't have predicted that the UFC is doing some of the things they're doing now, you just instinctively knew that this was an end of an era. It's particularly where you were going from, you know, the difference between WME and the Fertittas is that, okay, the Fertittas were billionaires, and that gave them a lot of latitude to kind of, you know, pull off what they were intending to do. But for everything you could say about the Fertitta brothers, could criticize them with, the UFC was a passion project of theirs. They fully believed in their product. They were committed to it. You know, there aren't too many There aren't too many, you know, hedge funds out there that are going to stick with a product like the UFC was in 2000, early in the last decade, where not too many cold corporate types are going to let a product lose $44 million with no sense of turning things around in sight. It'd still plow on forward anyways, the way the Fertitta brothers did. So it was, you know, the UFC at the end of the day was, even though they were run by billionaires, it always had the feel of a large family run business. And you just instinctively knew when you heard the numbers and you heard the people involved that, okay, this is the end of an era right here. I don't know. Back then, you didn't know what the change was exactly going to be, but you just instinctively knew things were going to be different. And then from there, you start wondering, like, okay, you know, are key people going to be kept on? Maybe the first thing I thought was, well, they need to keep someone knowledgeable like Joe Silva in place because, you know, the UFC, this isn't like any other. Something as intricate as matchmaking for fighting isn't like any other just widget that you can manage with a spreadsheet. Yeah. But of course, and then they went in, you know, Joe's gone from the company now, and you've seen the round of layoffs. You've seen some very different matchmaking than what we've become used to over the last decade or so in the UFC. You've seen they're handing out belts like Halloween candy now. In my head back at the time when this came out, I don't know if it was a worst case scenario, but you're thinking, well, what type of moves can they make that show maybe they don't know this industry as well as the people they're buying from? And, that certainly seems to be starting to play out a little bit.
Yeah, I think everyone kind of agrees that 2017 is going to be very interesting just for the fact of seeing how this blueprint that they have behind closed doors, how it's going to lay out in terms of, you know, pay-per-view events, this negotiation for the TV deal, which is going to obviously start at some point this year, for how they're going to position that for going forward, how they structure events, and just, you know, the Rousey thing this week alone with the press, I think it's been something that is kind of like, you know, this conflict of interest type stuff, and, you know, the unions and pay, and there's never been an era, I think, in UFC where there's been more fighter discontent. That's something Dan Stutt mentioned with talked to me about the other day, was he thinks in the year ahead something to watch is really just this growing kind of discord among fighters and all that. So it's gonna be fascinating stuff. So they paid a pretty penny for it. Now they have all the headaches that came with it. It's quite a story. I would argue it might even be the story of the year.
Yeah, I mean, story of the it could, you know, it's most likely going to be the story of the decade, unless to top the UFC changing hands, if something else is going to be a bigger story of the decade, it's going to have to be one whopper of a story.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go over the rest of the headlines for the month and get any thoughts you have, anything that stood out to you. We start with we had verbal agreements between Michael Bisping and Dan Henderson made for an October rematch at UFC 204, something that everyone was kind of head-scratching of how Dan Henderson was going to get a title shot. But, you know, again, in the new era, all things make sense. And also, Gegard Mousasi, Vitor Belfort was signed for the co-main event. Pete Williams and Mark Coleman, their epic fight was going to be added to the UFC Hall of Fame. Conor McGregor's mainstream tentacles, so to speak, started reaching out. He was seen training with the Mountain from Game of Thrones. He also was slated to appear in the ESPN Body Issue. He also won an ESPY along with Holly Holm, so we kind of started to see Conor McGregor again become more and more saturated in the mainstream sports market, and it was obviously going to mean some big things for him down the road. Frank Mir asked for UFC for his release so he could actually go fight somewhere overseas. Talking about that whole UFC 200 fight week, two things that are kind of overshadowed was Fight Pass show Thursday night. Eddie Alvarez knocked out Rafael Dos Anjos to win his first UFC lightweight title. Obviously, he was a former Bellator lightweight champion. Really, kind of just this whole story of how Eddie got to the UFC, finally kind of reached his coronation with just a great performance over Rafael Dos Anjos on that Fight Pass show. And then, obviously, on that Friday night, Tough 23 finale, Joanna Jędrzejczyk down in Claudia Gadelha in a very close fight to retain her strawweight title. Will Brooks making his UFC debut. Again, the former Bellator lightweight champion, and he won in his debut against Ross Pearson. Demetrius Johnson was hurt. He was out of his fight against Wilson Hayes at 201. We had a new plan for Tough 24, speaking of DJ, with all of a sudden all flyweight tourney of champions announced. Dana White insisting that GSP doesn't want to fight still, which was kind of a head-scratcher for those that kept hearing that GSP wanted to fight. We headed to South Dakota for a big UFC event, a UFC event that happened the week after 200, which just kind of overshadowed it completely. Fun show, though. John Lineker missing weight but still knocked out Michael McDonald. And then Tony Ferguson, who was supposed to fight Khabib Nurmagomedov on that show, submitted an unknown but now known commodity in Landon Venata. Dana White was confirmed to speak at the Republican National Convention, and quite a speech it was for those that didn't see it, or those that have saw it. UFC announced they were heading to Hidalgo, Texas, for a show headlined by Dustin Poirier and Michael Johnson. They also announced they were heading back to Portland, Oregon for a fight night coming up in the fall. Carlos Condit and Damian Maia get moved off of 201 to headline a UFC on Fox show instead. We actually had, obviously, UFC 201, again, overshadowed completely by UFC 200 down in Atlanta. Tyron Woodley just crushing Robbie Lawler to win his first UFC welterweight title. Carolina Kovacevic, I almost got that right, down to Rose Namajunas to earn her strawweight title fight. And then Jake Ellenberg, and quite a stunner, beating Matt Brown on that show as well. Chad Mendez got a two-year ban from USADA and ended up just fully accepting it and just owning up to it. Had a UFC on Fox show. Valentina Shevchenko upset Holly Holm. And then Edson Barboza dominated Gilbert Melendez, the returning Gilbert Melendez, and a show that got really big ratings and showed that there was a little bit of a star power there with Holly Holm left over from her beating Ronda Rousey. Despite saying he would leave UFC after a sale, Joe Rogan signed a one-year deal to remain as the color commentator. We learned that Rory McDonald was a free agent, obviously, and he was talking to Bellator, of all places. Also in Bellator, Benson Henderson, Patricio Pitbull, a number one contender's fight for the lightweight title was signed. MVP crushed Cyborg's skull in London in a and then did the Pokemon type thing afterwards. For those that remember that, that was something that actually got a lot of mainstream pub with the x-rays and all that. Bellator denied accusation of falsifying medical reports by Zach Light. Zach Light now part of the MMAAA, interestingly enough. Darren Caldwell is someone that Bellator really kind of wants to have as a top bantamweight and hopefully maybe be their champion at some point. That kind of got derailed. He was upset at a Bellator event by Joe Tamangelo. Bellator also signed the late Kimbo Slice's son, Baby Slice. Matt Mitrione, in a very kind of bizarre quick turnaround that was a head-scratcher, was cleared to fight in 3 weeks after nearly getting knocked out. So that was kind of a weird thing there. We learned that Mirko Krokop, of all people, is coming out of retirement. He got released by the UFC. He said that USADA wanted to be a snitch in order for his suspension to be lifted early. That was kind of bizarre. And then Fedor Emelianenko's victory, quote-unquote victory, over Fabio Maldonado was overturned. And there was a lot that happened in July. Anything there that stuck out to you as newsworthy?
You know, a few of these, I had to go all the way back to the beginning. I don't know, maybe I was going against the grain at this one. I was A-okay with Bisping versus Hendo right out of the gate.
Okay.
Maybe because I'm a, I don't know, I'm kind of a softie for, you know, rematches like this. You know, Bisping, I'm not in any way going to claim Hendo was actually the number one contender, but he's coming off a solid fight. The timing was never going to be better. You know, some of the other guys, the other contenders weren't necessarily lined up properly in terms of timing. And at the end of the day, with 2020 hindsight, there turned out to be a heck of a fight. So I was never wrong with that. I never had a problem with that. You know, it's weird of a thing to pick out of all those. I love that fight between Tony Ferguson and Lando Venata because, I mean, if you can't get behind like an underdog who no one's ever really heard of, unless you've actually been hanging around the Jackson Wink gym, coming out and pushing a guy like Tony Ferguson the way he did and doing so in a matter, you know, it's really, excuse me, it's really satisfying to watch an underdog who completely fights in a way that ups his stock, even in defeat. And somehow the guy who is supposed to win the fight easily still looks good as well. And, what else here? You know, I was just completely stunned to see, I'm not going to lie, I was stunned to see Woodley just smoke Lawler the way he did. That fight's been almost criminally overlooked in terms of big results this year, but I wouldn't have been surprised if Woodley won, but I was not expecting anything nearly that one-sided.
Hmm. We'll go to August, and by comparison, August was quite tame. Other than the big story of the month, which was UFC 202, what would be the biggest pay-per-view buy rate that UFC has ever had, number one, which is just it just amazing considering the year they've had and the star that Conor McGregor has become. Conor McGregor versus Nate Diaz, the rematch. I was reading some stuff leading up to this today. And they said, you know, there was like some ticket sales issues supposedly going in, and some people were like, ah, there's not a lot of buzz for this for whatever reason. That all was complete bullshit because this was a turned out to be a huge success, and just some of the headlines from this and some stuff I completely forgot about. You know, Conor obviously getting his revenge by being Nate Diaz in this really just fun, great, awesome, just a fun fight to watch. It was emotional. It had its moments back and forth. This is exactly why you buy stuff on pay-per-view and why you pay the big ticket prices to go. On the undercard of this this pay-per-view show, or its co-main event, rather, Anthony Johnson completely just decimated Glover Teixeira in 13 seconds. Uppercut from hell, out like a light, done. Cody Garbrandt got another big win and on his march to getting a title shot. Donald Cerrone knocked out Rick Story with this amazing combination that was just a thing of beauty. And then if you remember afterward, you know, Nate is talking to the media, and they did not do a full presser, if I remember right, after the show, which is people are kind of like, this is weird. They didn't really have an area, so to speak, or whatever. So he's kind of doing this mini scrum, and he's smoking a vape pen with pot in it, or metabolites, whatever you want to call it. And everyone's like, huh, that's kind of interesting. And USADA would kind of pick that up and be like, well, you shouldn't be doing that. And that was a little bit more of an investigation. And obviously leading out of this, Conor McGregor's future. He was saying his next fight might not be in the UFC. The question was he ever going to defend his featherweight title? Was he going to go for this trilogy fight? And there was just all these questions. UFC 202 was everything. It was just so much fun. Just stars, big results, people getting moved forward in nice positions. This was, you know, as the kids say, all that in a bag of chips.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm kind of struck by, you know, we're talking right now. It's 2 days before the Ronda Rousey-Amanda Nunes fight. And I'm just struck by UFC 202 just kind of reminds me of just the contrast between how Ronda handled defeat and how Conor handled defeat. Because Ronda disappeared for a year. She's refusing to talk to the media as we speak right now. Not really, you know, they're not really something fans kind of tend to relate with. Conor, on the other hand, loses the fight to Nate Diaz, which he, you know, Conor could have said no in the first fight with Nate Diaz and not come back. Not taking that fight at UFC 196. Instead, he loses. And instead, his reaction was, you know, I'm going to get back on the horse. I want to get this win back. I thought he was nuts for accepting the rematch at welterweight. And then not only did he do that, but that fight was just scintillating fight. Just so many twists and turns. And, you know, if you remember, much like in the first fight, Conor started off fast and started to fade in the second round, and it looked like it was going to finish the same way the first fight did. And then Conor finds a second win, and Nate starts to slow down, and then, you know, everything but the kitchen sink in the final round. And everyone was in breathless anticipation right up until the time that the decision was announced. And, you know, so in doing so, in handling defeat the way he did, Conor redeems himself, makes himself a bigger star. Of course, goes on from there to win the lightweight title. You know, that's the blueprint on how to handle a defeat if you're a star. And to me, I'm getting a little off subject here, but to me, even with a loss this year, I think Conor McGregor is the no brainer choice for Fighter of the Year. And you know, insisting on doing what he did at UFC 202, going back up to welterweight and fighting Diaz again, and staring down his loss and getting his retribution was the biggest moment, biggest turning point in getting there.
Yeah, this I think just both guys seem to, you know, there was so much trash talk, obviously, in the 12 days before the first one, and obviously everything afterward. And, you know, you're right. I think McGregor owned it, and there was a lot of questions, I think, for those of us like yourself and myself and so many others that listen to this, that We're interested in the business aspect of things and how people are positioned and what they do and potential drawing power and all that. And, you know, the thing was, like, what happens when McGregor loses? Because we know it's going to happen eventually, and how you handle it. It was the same thing when Ronda lost. And yeah, instead of, you know, she was hiding her face in an L.A. airport, and Conor was just, he was owning it. He was out there, and he wasn't you know, in his post-fight promo and everything, he wasn't shying away from it. And I think had he had he kind of just gone into character mode or all this stuff? He understands that moment, and he let Nate own the moment. And Nate, there's this kinship between them, even though they're rivals in the cage. They still talk so much trash by each other afterwards. And if this third fight ever does happen, which, you know, Dana White seems to not want to do, but I think we all agree we're probably going to see at some point.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
It's
going to
happen, right? But there's a respect between these guys and like how this fight got made, and they know that they can both make a ton of money out of each other. There's just this, you know, in these great trilogy fights in history, and these great rematches and everything. There just has to be that extra thing, and you can't manufacture it, and these guys have it, and this just completely just I'm glad McGregor won because. It's a nice, it adds this another level to the story that is still needs to be kind of fully wrapped up. This is just a perfect ending to this second fight, I thought.
And, you know, I wouldn't put too much weight in Dana trying to downplay the fight right now, because that's a fight that he can stick in his back pocket and go to it, you know. And it'll, no matter what happens in the career of Conor or Nate in the next year or so, like, he can put that in his back pocket and know it's going to be a gigantic fight, no matter what. So I wouldn't put too much stock into him trying to publicly downplay expectations now. But, you know, like you said earlier, so not only was Conor come through and what was really kind of his moment he needed to step up to, but as you said earlier, it was just a fantastic night of fights all up and down the board with meaningful results. And, you know, like you said, Rumble did what he had to do against Glover, and Donald Cerrone, that was the moment where you're like, the way he picked him apart, that was just like, wow, okay, Donald Cerrone really is going to be legit at welterweight. And it was everything delivered on that night. And in some ways, it was almost like the opposite of UFC 200.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways it was. And I think what we see in some of these events, talking about 200, 202, the Madison Square Garden show, is I think if UFC in the future does decide to kind of wean off pay-per-view to the extent of, like, you know, more and more Fox shows and maybe less pay-per-views, I think we're going to see a lot of pay-per-views like the one, these stacked shows where it's like, I have to pay, and probably there's going to be a price increase at some point. If I'm going to sure. Say there's only going to be like, 6 a year, right? But they're going to be complete stacked shows. They're going to say, okay, you're going to pay $75 for it. But look, I mean, you look at up and down the card and you're like, wow, this is completely worth it. You know, I think we're kind of seeing, because you know, there's so much buzz factor and so much positivity after these shows that have these name value guys, and there's results that push them forward. You know, Johnson, without a doubt, was the number one contender for the light heavyweight title again after this, and in a way that people are like, I want to see him fight Cormier again. Cerrone, just this march of 170. And then, again, Cody Garbrandt really put in a good position there where, you know, he was calling out Dominic Cruz leading up to this and then afterward. And it's like, huh, you know, I kind of do want to see that. It makes sense to do these things where the stakes matter. I think it's what a lot of us fight fans look for in all this stuff. And with so many shows, it's tough to find where stakes and fights matter. In 202, all the fights seem to matter. All the big fights seem to matter. And that's a great thing to have when you're asking people to pay good money for these shows.
And, you know, not to belabor the point, but coming off of UFC 200, where the fans, where the casual fans may not have thought it was the greatest night of fights, it was important that the show delivered, UFC 202 delivered, and it did.
And we didn't even mention the water bottle toss and the Nate Diaz walkout of the press conference going up. I mean, that was just something, you know, talking about, you know, legal action and all this stuff. And it was just something else. The Diaz brothers and Conor McGregor, when you get them together, magic happens. And I can't wait for this third one to happen at some point.
And, you know, say what you will about, because both of these guys got criticized quite a bit when it happened, but I do think that the water bottle incident did play a big role in getting the public back to come back around on that fight, because it didn't seem a week and a half going into it like there was all that big of a buzz, and then it was like night and day, you know. So maybe Conor planned that. You don't know what, you don't know really what's real and what's pre-planned in those type of situations, but yeah, whatever it was, it worked.
Absolutely. It was great stuff. And really kind of that was the big event of the month. The other thing you talked about a little bit ago was, you know, this report that Joe Silva was going to be leaving the UFC. And I think immediately people thought that, with a sale that all of a sudden these people were going to get like shoved out the door. And really what we learned shortly thereafter and really should have thought from the start was that these guys are making a ton of money from the sale. And the guys yep. like a Joe Silva, who had obviously made millions and millions and millions of dollars for these fights he put together for the UFC. Such an important component. Didn't really do a lot of interviews ever and just was kind of this figure in the background. Kind of brought Sean Shelby along after he came on from WEC. And then, you know, all of a sudden it's like he's like, I'm good. I made my money. I don't really want to do this anymore. And I'm going to start planning my exit. And I remember when this first story first broke is like, wow, Joe Silva's leaving? Like, why? He's a young guy. Why would he want to do this? And it makes sense if he's just like, I'm good, I'm done, you know? And this was, you know, something we obviously see confirmed in about a month later or so. But this was kind of a signifier of what was to come. And this just added kind of this air of uncertainty with a new ownership group.
It really was. And, you know, like, as you said, you know, Joe had points in the company and he's never going to have to work another day in his life if he doesn't feel like it. And he's always had interests outside of fighting. But, you know, like, nonetheless, I mean, you just, okay, Sean Shelby's a fantastic matchmaker. I have no doubt that he's going to flourish in his new role. But Joe Silva was the longest remaining, the person with the longest affiliation with the UFC is yeah. John McCarthy, going back to UFC 2, but that's through the commissions, not directly employed by the UFC. Joe Silva went all the way back to, I want to say, UFC 6 or 7. He, just as a fan, wrote a letter to Campbell McLaren, pretty much criticizing everything Campbell was doing. And back in those Wild West days, Campbell McLaren actually, like, called him and talked, and ended up hiring this kid more or less straight out of college to ultimately become his matchmaker. So you're talking someone who predated the Fajitas and Dana White, and to thrive the way Joe Silva did as a matchmaker. I mean, you can count on one hand the people in this industry who have had real long sustained runs as the booker, so to use the pro wrestling equivalent. And you know, it just, again, Joe Silva was the one who decided, you know what, I've made my money. I'm young enough. I can do something else. I'm good. But it just speaks to, like, erasing that type of that much institutional memory and knowledge of the product just kind of underscores how much change is afoot.
Yeah. And you allude to it. He understands pro wrestling, you know, and that's a good thing. So many people make, pro wrestling and MMA shouldn't, you know, it's not the same thing. People, it is, in a lot of ways, it is the same thing. You're trying to put together attractions, build up contenders, and the fact he understood pro wrestling probably made for some pretty goddamn good fights along the way. So, well, you know this as well as I do, because being a pro wrestling fan, as you are.
Absolutely. You know, you also have to learn the right lessons, you know. You know, it's probably a topic for another day, but Joe Silva understood the right lessons to learn from wrestling in terms of promoting product and presenting grudges that people want to see and whatnot, but he never really crossed the line, so to speak.
Mm. Let's go over the rest of the headlines for August 2016. We had George St. Pierre, this ongoing dance, will he, won't he, coming out and saying that he wants to fight, obviously, new welterweight champion Tyron Woodley, and he started the USADA process for his return, so everyone's kind of looking ahead to Toronto. We obviously know that wouldn't happen. A lot of other issues going on there. But GSP getting out there and saying that he wants to be fighting and wants to be back in it, even though Dana White keeps insinuating that he doesn't want to fight. So interesting stuff there. Rafael Dos Anjos versus Tony Ferguson, an awesome fight, was scheduled for November. Mark Hunt still furious about the whole situation with Brock Lesnar. Who knew what when? Decided he was going to refuse the USADA test and was very vocal about that. Speaking of USADA, Nick Diaz got in a verbal skirmish with a USADA agent, filmed the whole thing, put it on Snapchat. It was quite a hilarious string there going on a weeknight. And in that whole thing, the Diaz brothers, as we mentioned, are just, you know, no shortage of headlines. Good stuff. Another kind of big story, and something that's kind of got slept on a little bit, is the ABC signed to adopt some new rules for the year ahead and going forward, with new rules of grounded opponents, some new kind of adjustments to the judging criteria. iPoke, some other things as well. And obviously, as these new changes take place, people are going to have to get reacclimated. It'll be kind of interesting to see how everyone adjusts to the new rules. And it's going to be kind of weird for a while, but hopefully things will settle out. And not the sweeping changes I think a lot of us want, but it's a good start. Cyborg Justino, she was announced she was going to main event a Fox Sports 1 show against somebody called Lena Landsberg. So, you know, go from there. Nick Diaz, we just mentioned him, was starting to call out some people, but he has some certain restrictions on how he was going to come back, who he was going to fight against. We're still waiting to see him return. Melvin Gallard was suspended for a year due to a drug test failure while fighting in Bellator. The aforementioned Conor McGregor decided he was going to rant against some WWE talent that got a lot of people buzzing, both in WWE fan bases and all that stuff. So the man that knows how to pull the puppet strings knows how to even cross over into other industries and sports and all that. UFC's debut in Salt Lake City, a return to Salt Lake City, whatever it was. Yair Rodriguez downed Alex Caceres in the main event, and Dennis Bermudez returned to the winner's circle. CM Punk, a 4-part documentary series, was set to air in September on FS1 in anticipation for his first fight. Speaking of just Cyborg Justino, a weight-cutting documentary video series, whatever you want to call it, was released, and it was shocking to say the least, a lot of which was used recently on Outside the Line. So the weight-cutting issues and all that with Cyborg Justino was getting a little bit more attention. Another UFC Fighters Union started to come into play. So again, we're kind of seeing these splintering groups, obviously not the AAA yet, but still these groups, these unions are trying to get out there and trying to get some foothold and trying to get some backing as well. Ben Rothwell, out of his Fabricio Verdum co-headliner at UFC 203. Travis Brown decided to step in, and wow, what a weird fight that would be. UFC Manila got the returning BJ Penn versus Ricardo Lamas as a headliner. UFC Portland got John Lineker versus John Dodson in a really fun fight as a headliner. Leslie Smith, sad story, came out and said she had a tumor and unfortunately couldn't afford the treatment. A few days later, eventually UFC helped out with some of the medical payments there. Tim Kennedy, the returning Tim Kennedy against the returning Rashad Evans, booked for UFC's debut at Madison Square Garden. Dana White started insinuating that John Jones' USADA findings, quote-unquote, could look good. So people kind of got excited maybe that John Jones could come back sooner than later. Obviously, that was not going to be the case. The UFC sale was officially completed. Rory McDonald ended up signing with Bellator, so they signed another big free agent. Unfortunately, he's not set to debut until some point in 2017, kind of losing some of the momentum there. On the flip side, Donald Cerrone deciding to sign, stay with UFC, signing an 8-fight deal. Months later, he would come out with this another union, and that whole kind of weird situation there with him and Dana and the union and non-union and all this stuff. Speaking of Dana, he said that Ronda Rousey's return to pay-per-view, which coincidentally will be this weekend, is going to be the quote-unquote biggest UFC pay-per-view ever. So we'll get a chance to see if that's the case. Bellator 160, Benson Henderson continued his strange run in Bellator, defeating Patricia Pitbull in very strange fashion. Pitbull was lighting him up, then got hurt, and Benson Henderson, by proxy, ends up getting a title shot at Michael Chandler. And then finally, UFC and Fox 21. Carlos Condit got tapped out by Damian Maia in the main event. No big surprise there. Started talking retirement again after the fight. Anthony Pettis tapping out Charles Oliveira in his featherweight debut. And the one and only Paige VanZant knocking out Beck Rawlings to continue her march towards superstardom. What do you think of that month?
For a month that lacked the nonstop blockbuster headlines of July, there were just a nonstop kind of steady drip of interesting stories, even if they weren't necessarily blockbusters. Rory signing with Bellator was kind of eye opening for me, because it showed that there was something about Rory signing that really made it click to me. They're like, okay, free agency is a real thing. We had seen a few signings before, but then we also saw, if you recall, Rory didn't look very good again his last UFC fight against Stephen Thompson, and Bellator bit on him anyways. And that shows me that, I don't want to say that they're in it for keeps, because all it takes is one change in ownership at a television station and things can, go take a 180 degree turn overnight. But, someone like Rory, who isn't necessarily, he's a good fighter. He has a fan following, and, they might be able to draw a couple of good gates in Canada with him, but he's not, you know, he hasn't quite been champion. He's not a legend of the sport. That just, to me, it showed the depth to which Bellator to which they seem to be committed, at least at this point in time.
Yeah, and I think helping kind of keep leave that free agency door open for guys considering leaving UFC or at least shopping around, I think that's a good thing. Whether, you know, I think the key, and I said this at the time, is keeping this consistent with signing guys and really being aggressive. And for all intents and purposes, I guess they talked to Alistair Overeem. They talked to, obviously, Mitrione, who signed. Talked a little bit to Aljamain Sterling, but didn't really seem to bite too much there. So, I mean, I think just kind of making offers and aggressive offers to get exciting fighters over and make good fights, put on better shows, and they're getting there. It's just, again, with McDonald, I mean, this was back in August, and we're in December. We still don't know when he's going to debut. So it killed that momentum a little bit. But, you know, if he comes in and has a really impressive win, say, you know, first quarter of next year, or if he does want to wait till the summer, you know, perhaps maybe that momentum will pick up a little bit. We go to September. We'll round the bend. And this was an interesting month for a lot of reasons. And we'll start out with a former WWE champion making his UFC and MMA debut. It was much discussed on our website, other websites. CM Punk making his Octagon debut and not exactly showing and making a great accounting for himself against one Mickey Gall. Gall pretty much ran through him, submitted him. Punk's ear was all messed up after the fight. There was some weird questions going into this with, you know, this waiver period for amateur fighters turning to pro that Ohio kind of just waived. And it wasn't really a big deal, but it was kind of made into a little bit of a big deal. People kind of wondering what was going on there. This was just that whole licensing thing, the Mickey walkout song that Mickey Gall wanted to walk out to. That was initially scrapped, but social media got behind it, and all of a sudden we got that again. What song Punk would come out to, and obviously the afterward, you know, Punk making, it was revealed, making $500,000 minimum for the show, which just lit up the internet for a good couple days with fighters upset about this and not understanding about how people draw and how, you know, a lot of people couldn't draw the amount, and it actually may have turned out to be a bargain for UFC in the long run. And also on the show, Stipe Miocic, his hometown crowd, main event, crushed Alistair Overeem, got tagged a little bit early on, but came back, and really just one of those moments, and this is, you know, the year of the land in a lot of reasons, in a lot of ways. And Stipe was, Stipe is Cleveland, man. He is like a salt of the earth guy there, and just they love him, and he closed out the show in a big way. We had the aforementioned bizarre fight between Fabricio Werdum and Travis Brown, which featured a flying kick to start the fight out of a Street Fighter, and then finished with a Werdum kicking Brown's coach, Coach Tarvarian, Ronda Rousey's coach, Coach Edmund. And that was just the weirdest thing. And then Faber losing on the show to Jimmy Rivera. And leading into this week, we had the elevator accident that Faber was in and CB Dolloway was in. Hurts his back, can't fight, can't leave Cleveland. I think he was there for maybe almost 2 weeks afterward because he couldn't fly. There was all kinds of issues. He still hasn't come back in the cage yet. This is a fun show with a lot of, like, kind of, you know, fender bender car crash type elements, and one that did really well on pay-per-view to the point that we think that Punk is probably going to come back at some point early next year.
Yeah, let's start with that, because I got to be honest with you. Coming out of that show, I will give Punk credit for, he ended up generating interest. But my immediate impression out of that, which still holds today, is I would be completely fine with never seeing CM Punk fight again. At the end of the day, here's the difference between, you know, wrestling and MMA. At the end of the day, you can quote unquote book everything in order to kind of move the ball forward. But if you don't do it in the cage, that was just a level that was, and it just did an astonishingly embarrassing performance once they actually closed the Octagon door to another inexperienced opponent. And to me, that was such a stinker of a performance by Punk that maybe I can kind of see justifying farming Punk out to one of those Fight Pass affiliated promotions and having him fight in a smaller promotion and putting it on Fight Pass and using that as a way to draw people to Fight Pass. But man, I don't know, man. At least the UFC was lucky enough that you know, Mickey Gall's got a long way to go as a fighter, but he's a legitimately solid prospect. At least that came out of it. I know we're supposed to credit Punk for going through with the fight and whatnot, but he got paid well for it. They brought a lot of attention to more attention than what would have come to what that show would have gotten. And those fans got to see, you know, the CM Punk fans from wrestling got to see that tremendous Stipe Miocic fight. But I never want to see Punk fight again myself. But, you know, see, the Stipe fight was tremendous. I mean, it's very rare in this business that, you know, Stipe Miocic is a super good dude. He had the great story, won the heavyweight title, come to his hometown, got an all-time memorable. I mean, it was the reaction to Stipe in Cleveland is right up there with, like, George St. Pierre in Montreal, to use an example, or actually Uriah Faber back home in Sacramento a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
So all in all, it was an interesting, a memorable night, and you know, it was a great finish there with Stipe nearly getting finished by Overeem and then rallying and winning the fight.
Yeah, with the only thing with Stipe that gets me is his flat brim hat that he kind of wears crooked a little bit in the back, and it just it looks so weird. I don't know. It just he's like he's a firefight. He just does not look like a guy who would come out to hip hop music with a flat brim hat, a crooked flat brim hat. I don't get that impression from him. Every time I see him, just it's such a funny thing to me. It's just part of the mystique and all that.
It is. His Twitter feed, his Instagram are hilarious, and somehow that doesn't quite translate to when you stick a microphone in front of him. But you know, again, it's rare in this business that good things happen to good people. And, you know, that was one of the best good things happening to a good person this year. That Stipe Miocic, his entire year culminating in his hometown title defense.
So I completely agree about the Punk thing with him. I think, and this is, I wish they had more of these, kind of like back in wrestling when they would, you know, NWA would have a contract of a talent and they would loan him out to other groups and, you know, the groups
sure.
would pick up the cost and all stuff. You're right. They have, and I've thought about this the other day, they had, you know, they have Fight Pass. They want people to watch Fight Pass and buy Fight Pass and everything. So put him on Fight Pass and have him work with one of these other, you know, 18,000 groups that have shows every single night there and just say, look, we're going to loan you out. He'll still be under our contractual control. They could split the cost. UFC could just say, listen, we'll pay X to have him go fight. He can main event there, draw some attention on Fight Pass, fight against someone that doesn't have to be signed to a UFC deal. Like you mentioned, could be just someone at his level and see where you go. It's almost like having a minor league without actually having quote unquote the minor leagues, and just keep the shine on getting to the UFC, but also keep the promotional aspect where you can same thing with Mickey Gall in a lot of ways. You know, Mickey Gall just recently won. There's no obvious next opponent for him because you got to bring someone else in that's on his level, or else you got to throw him into deep water and you may potentially kind of ruin the prospect thing before you get a chance of going. Same with Punk for a draw perspective. You have this platform, you have these groups that would love to take him in a second. And he's saying he's willing to fight in an organization that's not UFC. Get the best of both worlds and go for it. But that's kind of the business for it. Just it seems it would make sense, but I don't think they're going to do that. I think we're going to see him on pay-per-view in like March or something.
Yeah, well, you know, I already stated my opinion on that one, so that nothing's going to change there.
UFC 205, we'll go to this next. This was obviously the UFC's debut in Madison Square Garden. We keep talking about these big events with 200 and 202. 205 was getting loaded up, and here's kind of just a breakdown of what we had. We had initially announced Robbie Lawler versus Donald Cerrone, which was taken from us in such a cruel fashion a few days later when Lawler decided to pull out of the fight, citing he needed more time after the Woodley fight, which you kind of think can go back even to the Condit fight. Lawler just needed some time off, some mental time off, and we're looking forward to seeing him back in there. Frankie Edgar versus Jeremy Stephens was announced. Chris Weidman, Yoel Romero, thanks to all people, Lorenzo Fertitta coming back in the mix and making that happen on behalf of Weidman. Just kind of a weird story there. Obviously, Rashad Evans versus Tim Kennedy. Kelvin Gastelum got put in that Cerrone fight instead. Misha Tate versus Raquel Pennington. Kalakevich versus Yuena Jacek for the strawweight title. And then with, you know, around the end of the month, we got this this big push from Conor McGregor, pushing for an Alvarez, a lightweight title fight with Eddie Alvarez. To he wants the two belts. He wants to be the first guy to hold two belts at once. Even though these contracts are already out to Khabib Nurmagomedov, and Dana White saying that McGregor's foot is hurt and probably he should fight Aldo at some point instead. McGregor saying, I'm not hurt at all. That was kind of strange. And eventually McGregor got the fight. He versus Eddie Alvarez was going to headline UFC 205. And this was something that we kind of felt there needed to be this big thing on top of the card. Woodley versus Stephen Wonderboy Thompson eventually announced that wasn't really going to be it. We finally get it, and then Khabib gets a fight against Michael Johnson, but he was obviously pissed off. Jose Aldo, as a result of all this, saying he wanted out of the UFC after this thing, the whole debacle. This was, it's Conor McGregor's world, as we keep mentioning during this stretch, and this was another case of it where he called the shots and he called Dana's bluff and called UFC's bluff. They were able to make a fight. This did huge business. But this show, they said, look, we're going to go to MSG for the first time. We're going to do something good. And there's a lot of doubts. And then they finally came through. And on paper going into this, this was arguably, if not 100%, the most stacked card they've ever done in company history.
Yeah. And, it's this is the point where I came to realize, all right, so over the last couple of years, we've gotten into this pattern where the UFC, they really hone in on these shows seemingly quarterly or so, where they absolutely stack and load up certain events and telegraph well in advance that this is going to be a huge card. And before the Conor fight was announced for UFC 205, again, the reaction, much like with UFC 200, was that people were disappointed, this isn't living up to expectations, blah, blah, blah. And that was the point where I realized, when they're building up these shows, unless Dana comes right out of the gate and says that, they're going to shoot fighters out of a cannon and raise Kimbo Slice from the dead and shoot off fireworks and blah, 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 blah. Like, people are going to be disappointed. They've just raised the level of expectation too high. And, it certainly didn't help that, Lawler versus Cerrone was just the most tantalizing tease of a fight I think we've ever gotten. And then it was gone as soon as it arrived. But as the fight card developed and as everyone was just pitching and whining, this fight card isn't good enough for the first one since Crocod and blah, blah, blah. I'm looking at the lineup and going, well, those two title fights that they announced before the Conor fight, like, those are great fights. Chris Weidman versus Yoel Romero is a hell of a fight. Misha Tate on the card, that's, on paper, that sounded great. And, okay, maybe it didn't have that spectacular, like, the cherry on top of the sundae, but it was actually, if for some reason the Conor fight didn't happen, it was still a hell of a lineup. But, kudos to Conor for throwing his name in the hat and understanding that, that his presence would be the thing that would push this over the top and make it one of the most memorable events ever. And, not just the historic nature of being the first show in Madison Square Garden, but also finally going after that second championship. And, I think to me the little lesson out of that is that when we're building these super cards several months in advance, just chill out and let them put a card together before we go deciding that, oh, hey, this card's not going to live up to expectations.
Yeah, I'm kind of the expectations that this Brooklyn show is going to be pretty good. Yeah, I'm kind of biting my lip on that one because right now we're running out of time with getting kind of a loaded show here. But yeah, I think you're right. I think fight fans, and I think I learned that a lot this year, was have a little patience, but it's good to have kind of a fervent fan base. But yeah, I think with especially with social, it becomes so easy to just all of a sudden get this feeling just like, what is going on? We know better. And sometimes you just got to let things play out. And you're right. All of a sudden, Conor comes, saves the day, and poor Khabib could not get the contracts in hand. He said he had two contracts, and all of a sudden he loses it. Again, Jose Aldo, he ends up just being irate at this whole thing. We're not really – he's going to come back to fight Max Holloway at some point, but he continues to chase Conor and just cannot seem to redeem himself for that 13-second knockout. And, he's saying he'd retire. He's talking about maybe throwing fights. It was just – You tell this a lot of frustration. Again, kind of looking at the fighter discontent, Jose Aldo was nearly leading that pack after this announcement.
You know, I did not buy for a second that he was retiring. I didn't buy that one for a second. Yeah. Jose, you know, I really feel like he misplayed his hand on that one. I feel that if Jose had come out and demand said, okay, I'm going to chase Conor up to 155 if I have to. Give me like a good lightweight fight. I'm ready to get back in the game. If he had like shown up in New York and held his own little press conference and stayed on top of his game, and stayed in the public eye, you know, Jose could have put public pressure on to make that match happen. Instead, he did the equivalent of like taking his ball and going home. And I really feel like Aldo kind of misplayed his hand in that one.
And then obviously, again, leading up to that, Tyron Woodley basically continuing to campaign to fight anyone, GSP, Nick Diaz, Nate Diaz, anyone, but Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. I think he said he didn't respect him as a man at one point, and I thought that was kind of strange. Anyone that knows or has talked to or seen Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, there's nothing really to hate there, you know, and he's trying to buzz. Just trying to deny this whole fight the whole time. The fight eventually gets signed for UFC 205, and we're going to get a rematch at some point. Finally, to kind of round out the bend here, and I want to throw a bone to Bellator. This, you know, this was kind of interesting in that, you know, we talked about the Rory signing kind of signifying one thing, and then all of a sudden we have the bad guy, Chael Sonnen, signing a deal with Bellator, announced by the Associated Press, and soon thereafter a fight with Tito Ortiz, booked for late January in Los Angeles, California, a place you obviously know pretty well, at the Fabulous Forum. And Chael Sonnen coming back to the mix, and you know, obviously Kimbo passing away early in the year. They continue wanting to get names, and you know, this is it's a fun fight. The interviews and promos have felt horribly forced, like just terribly forced. But I think when this is all said and done in January, it's at least going to be a fun show and attraction. And, you know, on a Saturday night in January, we'll take that.
Yeah, you know what? I love the signing of Chael. I gotta say that right from the top, because I feel like, you know, so Bellator had done this thing where they had gone for the short-term attention by signing these older names for quote-unquote legends fights. And it feel like they had that they had wrung every drop from that, you know, like the Bellator 149 was a fiasco on about 100 different levels. But they still, and yet they weren't quite there in terms of bringing up their younger talent. They have such great talent up and coming on that roster, but they're not over with the crowd yet. And, you know, I feel like Sonnen was the best move in order to kind of bridge that gap, because he's fresh. I mean, a fresh name in terms of someone he's been out of the limelight for a little bit. He can be matched up with a handful of fighters in interesting matches. But Chael is such a gifted promoter, not just a self-promoter, but I remember when that first night they were interviewing him after they signed him, he did a better job of plugging the upcoming Bellator event that was coming up that he wasn't on than Bellator has done for any of their damn shows. So, you know, Chael is always going to, you know, he's a smart guy. He takes care of himself, but he's a team player in the process. And for me, I think that Chael is a win-win proposition for Bellator. And like you said, if nothing else, it should be a fun night at the Forum.
Yep, and we need as many of those we can get. Things that stand out, you know, stakes in the UFC, things that stand out in Bellator. And now, I mean, look, UFC had to get off their block. They were having an event in hosting a pay-per-view in Anaheim that night, just about an hour or so away, give or take. And then, you know, some things fell through and they had to push that pay-per-view to August. And Bellator kind of jabbed at them on Twitter. And, you know, hey, they won out. And I think that'll be good. More tension on this fight. And, you know, again, the juice box stuff aside and just some of these horrible Ortiz promos aside, I think it's fun to have Chael Sonnen in some of these kind of interesting, fun fights. So hopefully he stays healthy and we see him in there a couple times in 2017. Let's go over the rest of the month and kind of round things up. Again, GSP, big surprise, wants a fight in Toronto. And again, it was kind of this whole big debate as far as who he's going to fight. Of course, the UFC want him back in Toronto, but not so fast as we would soon find out. Claudia Gadelha decided she was going to leave her longtime team, Nova Uniao. Let's see. We talked about Lars Cerrone targeted for UFC MSG. That got scrapped. UFC Hamburg. We had Josh Barnett submitting Andrei Arlovsky. Alexander Gustafsson returning and edging out Jan Błachowicz. And then Ryan Bader knocking out Ilir Latifi. Just Ilir Latifi's run towards a his light heavyweight contendership. Kind of an interesting name. That gets stopped cold, as it were, by Ryan Bader's knee. Misha Tate, you were just talking about, a fan favorite. Everyone loves her. Was on a hike and carried a girl with a broken arm down a mountain. Imagine that, right? That was kind of big. UFC 202, we found it was the biggest pay-per-view of all time, buys-wise, for UFC. So their continued 2016 success keeps going. Bellator announced they were heading to Israel with Andrei Koreshkov versus Douglas Lima, the rematch for the welterweight title on the line. Shane Carwin, remember him? He said he was going to come back to MMA with a sign a deal with Ryzen. Jordan Meehan, also remember him, deciding he was going to come out in retirement and fight in the UFC yet again. Bisping Hendo 2, the fight that you love so much and ended up being really fun in Manchester, England, sold out in 6 minutes despite this ridiculous start time of like 2 a.m., I think, or something along those lines. Just something that for the local fans there, they didn't seem to care, and they packed the house and sold out the show in 6 minutes. Luke Rockhold looking to get back to his 185-pound title. He was booked against Jacare Souza in a rematch. Jacare, unfortunately, can't seem to get a title shot no matter what he does, and they were going to fight at a headline show in Australia. That would soon get changed. There was a report that Fedor was offered $2 million to fight on New Year's Eve in Ryzen against possibly Vanderlei Silva. That ended up being scrapped later on down the road. Sad story. Kenny Florian's brother, Kirk, was missing and then found dead, unfortunately. UFC 207, the show at the end of the year, got a big rematch between Cain Velasquez and Fabricio Werdum. UFC Hidalgo, Derek Brunson TKOing Uriah Hall in the first round, and Michael Johnson coming back strong, crushing Dustin Poirier with a first-round knockout. It was announced that Alexander Gustafsson and Little Nogueira were going to headline UFC Fight Night in Brazil. Later on, Gustafsson got hurt, and then Ryan Bader, we just talked about him, he got subbed in instead. Kind of a story that was unfortunate because it was so much fun, especially after that Virginia show where he kind of challenged the crowd. Ally Quinta, the raging one, essentially retiring and going doing real estate and doing some other things because he was set to fight on this MSG show, but just contractually he just didn't like his deal, and UFC dug their heels in, and Ally Quinta was removed from that show, and we have not seen him since. So that kind of a sad story with a young, fun prospect there. Nate Diaz still not cleared by USADA after the vape pen incident we talked about. UFC confirms Joe Silva's departure, hires McManor to join the team there with Sean Shelby. We had this great, bizarre feud with a verbal feud with Vanderlei Silva and Crazy Horse Bennett over in Japan. These videos are something else. Don't ever get in a hotel lobby with those guys in Japan. We heard that Ronda Rousey, speaking of UFC 207, that she was going to finally return against Amanda Nunes. That was not confirmed at the time, but we soon would learn, obviously, coming up this weekend, that was going to be the case. UFC in Brazil, Cyborg Justino in the main event, running through Lena Landsberg. Roy Nelson signifying Bigfoot Silva's final UFC run, knocking him out, and then bizarrely kicked John McCarthy afterward, flipped him off because he thought it was a late stoppage. And then Henan Barão just, beating Philip Novera by unanimous decision, but just kind of really not really. He's in a very weird spot there at 145 pounds. And, can't really seem to find himself. Seems possibly just burned out from all the years of weight cutting. Dana White suggesting, as we mentioned, Conor's foot is hurt, so we can't fight Madison Square Garden. We found out that was complete crap. Bellator saying they announced Liam McGeary versus Phil Davis for a title fight in November. Mirko Krokop versus Vanderlei Silva 3, set for a Ryzen show on November 29th, but that would not happen. Ryback, talking about pro wrestlers. Ryback, it was revealed, was talking to Bellator about making his MMA debut. Nothing's come of that yet. And finally, the UFC gets 23 new quote-unquote A-list celebrity investors, none of which have actually tweeted about the UFC, I believe, since they actually became these investors, with the exception of Guy Fieri and, I believe, Rob Dyrdek. That was about it. So everyone else is kind of just fine to have this thing. They probably don't even know they partially own it, and it's probably just a very, very, very nominal fee and all that. So as we round out September, anything on that list stand out to you?
The whole when the talk with GSP, that actually ties a couple things together. When the talk with GSP started, there was almost this little frenzy of fighters who – you know, they're champions and they have pay-per-view points and whatnot, trying a little too hard to angle for the money fight. Like yeah. with Tyrone, you mentioned Tyrone Woodley earlier, and he, you know, he was trying, he comes off, he comes off his win over Lawler and immediately wants fights with Nick Diaz and with GSP and so on and so forth. Well, you know, sorry, Tyrone, but you haven't quite gotten to that. But like GSP and Nick Diaz are going to make more money fighting each other than they are you. So nice try, bud. And then at the same time, it seemed like there was a period of about a month and a half where Daniel Cormier used his spot on UFC Tonight to try to personally lobby to get GSP on the Toronto show that he was also scheduling to fight on, because he's going to make more money if GSP's on the show. And for some reason, September was the month where that all just kind of coalesced and became pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the era of unfortunate kind of started with champions. Even though you have a title on your shoulder and on your waist, even if it's an interim title, people just kind of call out all kinds of crazy things. And my hope for the year ahead in this transition, my final question for you, so 2017, I really hope that we get back to kind of the divisions mattering again and guys not jumping around and looking for quote-unquote super fights and money fights. And I think they're fun every once in a while. I don't like every division doing it. Any big predictions for the year ahead or hopes for the year ahead?
You know, I hope they do so too, but I have a feeling that we're going to continue to see more of it, because everything that we seem to see from WME so far seems to be about getting a rating now, as opposed to, you know, thinking several years down the future. Maybe they're trying to really pump this up so that they can make their big score on the next television deal, which I think is in 2018. But, you know, for example, last week, a couple weeks ago, we saw on the UFC on Fox show, they went with Paige VanZant and Sage Northcutt, and Uriah Faber's final fight was kind of shoved down the card a little bit. And they were obviously going for the TV rate, to pop a big TV rating there, and it worked. But, okay, Paige VanZant loses. Do they know what to do with Michelle Waterson now? Little things like that are the things I think you want to keep an eye on. And, you know, to that extent, like, adding weight classes. I get the feeling that if WME, you know, if someone wants to jump around a weight class, if it makes a bigger fight, a bigger short-term paycheck than, you know, making the right fight for a division, I do think we're going to see more of that, even though I'd rather we didn't.
Before we let you go, I want to give you a chance to plug your social media, stuff you're working on for both MMA Fighting and Yahoo, as well as a charity that you you did the ride for. I think people should know about that. So I'm going to throw the mic to you, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. I am on both Twitter and Facebook at Dave Doyle MMA, DaveDoyle MMA. And the charity that I did my bike ride for over the summer was for, it's a familiar one for MMA fans. It's Brian Stann's Higher Heroes USA. You know, they help veterans get job placements and good careers. And it's a worthy cause. It's a reputable charity. And again, man, there's no one more upstanding in this business than Brian Stann. So higherheroesusa.org is their website.
Excellent stuff. Well, Dave, we appreciate you spending the time with us. A crazy 3 months we talked about, and hopefully we'll get a chance to do it next year. Best wishes for the year ahead, and we'll talk to you at some point in 2017. Dave Doyle, thanks so much for joining Josh Jason's Punch Out this week.
Thanks for having me.
All right, big thanks to Dave Doyle for stopping by. Thanks to all you guys for listening. Not too much to add. Again, the voice is not that great, so I don't want to push it and make you guys sick. You know, that kind of that, was it placebo effect? Is that how that works? I don't know. Anyway, obviously, if this is the first one of these you're listening to, you missed out on Q1 and Q2. Q1 joined by Paul Fontaine of this site, WrestlingObserver.com, as well as MMADraws.com. And then Q2 just launched last week with John Nash, A Bloody Elbow, and that was about an hour and a half, so we went long on that. But these are a lot of fun. Q4 coming up maybe later this week, if not early next week, and it'll be off and running 2017. We'll come back on a regular schedule with refreshing content. Thanks for the positive feedback. These shows are always a lot of fun. The goal, as always, this is the second year I've done these. The goal for next year is to have them actually out in December, so we'll shoot for that. and need to be a little bit more organized than that. But you guys know holidays go and all that's a little bit tough. So that's about it. Again, kind of a not a big UFC event coming up this weekend, but a very weird January for them. Kind of quiet, which I think could be good as we transition into this this new regime, still this new ownership, and kind of figure out what their year ahead's going to be. BJ Penn returning after a long absence to take on Yair Rodriguez. On paper, this looks like a very one-sided assault potentially for Rodriguez, just a fast-rising prospect. And Penn, the last time we saw him was the weird tippy-toe dance against Frankie Edgar in that just sad fight, their trilogy fight that no one was really asking for, but we got anyway. So that'll be coming up on Sunday night from Phoenix, so we'll obviously have coverage on our side about that. And, of course, any other news and all that good stuff as well. So have a great rest of your week. Again, thanks to, I'm saying Matt Doyle. Thanks to Dave Doyle. Thanks to everyone. And until next time, insert catchphrase here.